creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Last week on Culture Click, we heard from Dr. Shigeko Sasamori on her encounter with the atomic bomb, which occurred in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. Dr. Sasamori recalled her own physical and emotional experience in the aftermath and spread her message for peace. Today on Culture Click, we visit with local artist and Winona State University professor Dan Eastman, who had the pleasure of hearing Dr. Sasamori speak twice, once this year and once in 2008. He was so moved by her speech that it inspired a whole new installment of art, which culminated in a gallery exhibition entitled Taboo. On this episode, we will hear a portion of Professor Eastman's gallery talk and then go to our one-on-one interview with him about his art. You're listening to Culture Click.
So, welcome and thank you for coming. I've been working on this idea of nuclear weapons and nuclear sensibility and nuclear technology for quite some time. And my first sensibility was looking at the history of Alamogordo in Los Alamos in New Mexico. And one of the things that struck me there was, of course, there's all of these things that go on, but there was a surprise at the detonation, the test detonation, the Trinity detonation, and it was called the Trinity test. And after all of this, everything cleared and everybody went out, everybody sort of gasped because there was about 600 square yards, what they called the green parking lot. The detonation had taken all of the sand, taken it up into the air, fused it into what looked like glass, and came back down. And that was a new element called trinitite. So to me, that started to deal with this idea of unexpected echoes, things that, not just consequences, but echoes, things that were happening around this massive technology. And then I was in the Caribbean, and in the Caribbean, their sense of the United States and nuclear weapons is way different than ours. We own them, they're wondering about them, and they went through the Bay of Pigs in a different way than we did. So to a certain extent, there's a different kind of fascination with this idea of what is a nuclear proliferation. In a nation like Barbados, there's less than a million people in the entire nation. They don't have nuclear technology, but they're fascinated by this idea of what does it do? Why do we have it? And along with all of those things, I came back and lo and behold, Dr. Sasamori, who's sitting over here, was giving a talk. She's a Hiroshima bomb survivor. And she gave a talk that just, both of those talks just stopped me in my tracks. This whole idea, what is memory? And I had been working with a quote from Faulkner in his novel, Light in August. It's five words. It's the opening sentence for chapter six. I've been trying to unpack those five words and may do so for the rest of my life. And those five words, memory believes before knowing remembers. And that in relation to her memory of what was it like to be a survivor of Hiroshima, spawned this work. Now, I'm a fabricator, so some of these things were before that. I had interest in that world before that. And a fabricator is someone who puts lots of things together. For instance, the big piece of glass over here was done in relation to trinitite, and that was done in conjunction with John Lewis Glass in Oakland. As I listened to Dr. Sasamori, this whole idea of what memory is and memory believes, and what she believes and her memories and how she was able to overcome that idea, because you can imagine how much despair there must have been, what it would be to survive that sort of thing. But her memories and her mission are ones of hope. And this whole idea of transforming despair into hope came to me to be a lot about, we cannot replicate Hiroshima. In fact, Dr. Strecker, a resident Japanese scholar, there's not much art in Japan on Hiroshima. The reason is you cannot replicate it. You cannot resemble it. But what can you represent? And what you can represent are some of these living memories. And if you, those of you who heard her, those memories are very protean in relation to not only what happened in its abject horror, but also what happened in the hope. For instance, she had some what really amount to to near-death experiences where she would see water and remember flowers and thinks she was somewhere else. In times of great stress, we conjure things. If we put you in a dark cave, you will conjure images. Our brains are very complex. And the complexity of her memories include all of these beautiful things. Even last night, she used the word beautiful or beauty five times. So this whole idea of how do you juxtapose those sorts of things and still use a medium that can be beautiful and conjure memories of horrific and hope. And that contradiction became how I tried to make choices. I was talking in Dr. Colazzi's class today, and I have a note scribbled on one of the tables in my studio. That note is a single word, and it's requiem. And requiem has to do with how do you honor the dead. And so when I had choices to make and places to make, and some of these things look like catafalques. Do you know what a catafalque is? It's a very strange term, but it's what coffins are carried on, set on. And so you have these horizontal surfaces, and then they get complex. She referred to keloid scars. Keloid is a scar that builds up over time from its own infection and starts to calcify. She talked about her own keloid scar. She had to have 23 surgeries on her neck before she could look up or down. Her chin was connected to her chest, these kinds of things. So many of these are reminiscent of the idea of keloid forms. This idea of replication, what you remember and what you don't remember, and where was it? A very confusing time. So some of these things are actually copies of each other, but they're fairly different. But the juxtaposition of many people think the false material is the real material. How do you figure this out? This whole world of ambiguity. Hopefully, none of us will ever have an experience that takes our mind to conjure their way out of a horrific situation. But what happens is you can't tell what is the original and what is real. Bud Rillard comes along again. He's a theorist who talks about you can't tell what is real or what an original is. And these things start to happen in people's lives at the edge of our experiences. And the whole point of this exhibit is not for you to tell you what to think or to show you what to think. It's to enter a place and use your senses to have an experience. And that experience is not going to be close or even attempted to be close to Hiroshima, but it is a chance for you to realize you don't have to think of everything. You have an emotional intelligence and just let some things happen. That's one of the reasons there's no labels, there's no title so that you can think this way or anything like that. Hopefully what art does is helps you ask questions. I don't know that art solves things. But in a culture, and particularly in this culture, comedians and clowns and the court jester and artists have permission to ask questions that can't be asked in some other venues. The question I'm asking you is, can you choose hope over despair? And that's really my talk.
Now that you have heard the gallery talk on Taboo by Dan Eastman, we go to our one-on-one interview with Dan about how culture inspired art. You're listening to Culture Click with Terry Temseth.
Dan Eastman, I'm the artist and sculptor concerning the exhibition Taboo.
Now, you're also a professor here at Winona State University.
Some would say.
And your area of expertise in that?
Here I teach in new media and visual culture and mass communication.
But you do have this art career on the outside.
Yes. I have two MFA degrees, one in scene design and one in sculpture. And I'm a Fulbright scholar in sculpture in Barbados and a conferred professor in sculpture at the University of West Indies in Trinidad.
Beautiful. What got you geared towards creating art?
Oh, this is a long story, I guess. I don't know. Some people say it all goes back to childhood. And in my childhood, I grew up in Oregon. And we stacked firewood all the time. My brothers and I turned this chore into some fairly interesting stacks of wood. And I think this whole idea of stacking things and fabricating stayed with me a long time. And when I had choices to make in terms of art, I became a sculptor and fabricator. I don't know if it's directly from there, but that certainly, in terms of starting, probably helped move me in that direction.
Did your parents ever say, hey, quit making art out of the wood?
No, my my parents, particularly my dad, said, go get another pickup full of wood.
Okay, so they didn't deter you from what you were doing whatsoever. No. I mean, some people might not know that you actually were involved with theater quite a bit.
Yes, I was in commercial theater in Chicago Scenic and designing around the country commercially. I was with the Utah Shakespeare, et cetera, et cetera. And then I realized that to a certain extent, fabrication, of course, scene design is really fabrication on a large scale. Mm-hmm. That I was making some choices that were much more intimate than that and weren't really a part of collaborating with things that existed with words before, and just made a natural transition. I don't think there's anything sinister about it other than finding out that focusing on smaller things was something I wanted to do. Now, smaller in relation to theater is instead of 53 feet wide, maybe only 4 feet wide.
Is it hard to downscale from that?
I think the next downscale may be the harder one. But
now, a couple of years ago, you heard Dr. Sasamori, Shigeko Sasamori, come and speak to us.
Yes, 2008.
Right.
Yes.
About her encounter with the atomic bomb on Hiroshima mm-hmm. in 1945. Mm-hmm. And when you were listening to that talk, what was going through your head?
Well, I had been working on a project called Trinanite, which was the Alamogordo test, where the test blast in the desert concerning the Manhattan Project actually created this kind of glass. It fused the sand, and it was a big surprise to everybody. I thought that whole idea of an unexpected echo was interesting. So I was thinking about that in a general sense. Of course, the result of that was the Angola Gay in Hiroshima. So it was, but I wasn't thinking about it directly as much as, here's someone, I'll go listen. And I was fairly taken by basically her memory and which parts of her memory were extremely lucid and factual and which parts became fantastical in relation to how the mind has to work to survive such a horrific assault on one's body and mind and brain and culture and all those things that were of a magnitude that we can't really fathom at all. And she's very articulate about that kind of story. It turned into some ways about memory and memory under an unbelievable duress, as well as the idea that her message is one that we should not do this anymore. The message is one of hope that we should stop nuclear proliferation under all circumstances, whether for war or anything else. And that all just sort of grew into over the years thinking and, again, it's a protean issue. How it grows from there gets to be fairly complex.
Right. Your pieces were fairly large that were in this gallery exhibition. Do you want to talk about how the different materials reflect what you had heard?
Well, in some ways, they're large in that I'm a fabricator. All the pieces were pretty small at one point. but I think one of the things that was that it would be human scale. Either the size of a body or slightly larger, so that we could relate to them when we step up to them viscerally, i.e. on par with how we stand on the earth. And then the other issue is, in terms of size, is many things were melded together during Hiroshima or any nuclear blast. So things get melded together, rubble and bone, all sorts of different materials literally become one in a kind of Baroque way, meaning it's just jumbled and jambled and compressed. So the idea of an accumulated volume was interesting as well. And then we can't really replicate that idea of a nuclear blast. We're not going to even resemble it. So how do we metaphorically put things together in relation to this kind of jumble, and how do we get that feeling from something much smaller? We simply cannot approach the magnitude of a nuclear explosion.
There was a lot of use of black, right?
Well, she talks about black, as does many of the other writers of the time. It's called the Black Rain. What came afterwards was the fallout, and it just created a black rain. I think they call it Pycodon, which also translates to big sound. And they were all pretty much deafened. So this idea that in this place where you couldn't see and you couldn't hear, they conjured all of these things. And I think using black helps set that mode. I don't think the right word is mood, but mode, sensibility.
it's creating a space.
Yeah, and also you're talking about different other artists like Rilke, who says, you know, there is a silence that surrounds. He's talking about space. So you set the exhibition up as an installation so that when you're in there, you have to negotiate the space. You have to, and the space negotiates you, moves you around, and some things are hidden, some things are not. It was a little overstuffed to a certain extent in that, can you imagine wandering around after a disaster like that? And what do you have to negotiate? Now, it wasn't to the point of sending the fire marshal in and telling us we can't do it.
Right.
But at the same time, it was a little different than a normal gallery, everything against the wall, everything with its own space, etc.
Right, like you would turn around, there would something be behind you, but not to the point where you would knock it over.
Exactly. And not to mention, it probably weighed 600 pounds.
Oh, how'd you get it in?
With casters and dollies and trucks. And
you would have to.
And very young backs.
Now, for the people that haven't seen it or weren't able to see it, you have these great sculptures. And then at the same time, there was use of color, very mm-hmm. vivid color.
Right, right.
And you had mentioned that that was going between the two different mental states mm-hmm. that Shigeko mm-hmm. had explained in her talk.
Exactly.
So she was going between the place that her imagination would drive her to be able to cope with what was going on,
right.
and then the actual dark rain part that you were talking right. about.
And so, some of the specific stories she would talk about was she would know she was near water, and she would, in a sense, conjure Edo or well and see flowers and think they were real, and then her mother would call her name, and she would be in, you know, the black rain again. Where's reality when you're so stressed that you conjure somewhere else? So this idea of space being not only where you are, but where your mind takes you. So the contrast between the black and the color and even the medium, the color was all on the paintings. And the black was all on the... Well, that's not true. There were some black parts in the paintings. But the sculptures were predominantly black.
And with the glass that you had talked about before.
Right. Exactly. I kind of pulled that along because it wasn't just in Alamogordo. Every nuclear blast since then that's been anywhere near San Bikini Island. And for instance, Hiroshima was called the City of Seven Rivers. It was called the City of Six Rivers after the blast. It literally flattened the river. There was lots of sand near the bridges where the Ground Zero was. And there was glass there. And if you go to the Peace Museum, you can see some of that there as well.
Now, you took how long to go ahead and create this project? When did you initially start it?
I guess if you think of it as starting with Alamogordo, when would that be? 2004 or 2005? You know, it's out there 4, 5, 6 years. And then since 2008, of course, that's been accelerated with her talk. So the most of it's been put together and certainly thought of as being coherent since 2008. And that was October, November of 2008, so really 2009. So we were just talking a kind of compressed last 2 years, but a kind of mounting 3 or 4 years in front of that.
Great. So now what happens to the exhibit?
Well, it's safely back in the barn. Horses are all back in the barn.
Okay.
I'm looking for a third part of this trilogy. For instance, there were 3 bronze there. There are 5 more bronze. I'll use some of those pieces, but with additional pieces that were not in the show, based on what would happen in the far future, distant future, if somehow they could send us a message, what would it be?
Oh, okay.
And of course, like all messages, it would be cryptic. For instance, things like each time, time after time, once masked, twice disguised. So even though it's some sense of what is or isn't, it wouldn't always translate as to a direction. Do not do this. They're not prescriptions. The far future may or may not have any idea what our culture is like anyway. For instance, we know X amount about, say, the Egyptian culture, but I suspect if we were dropped in time into the Egyptian culture, we may not know as much as we think. And of course, it's all also sent in rune stones. The next exhibition, this will be carved in granite kind of things, very substantial, permanent. It's all bronze and granite and glass.
And what kind of forethought do you have to take into that when working with those types of materials?
Number one, it's heavy.
Have a place for it?
You have a place for it now. Well, it can stay outside. A lot of stuff just stays out in the weather. But you put a piece of granite outside, it doesn't care.
Right.
Same with glass. It doesn't care. Bronze is fine. I think it has more to do with how do you create the conditions for making them. I don't have a foundry, so I use the Anarog Foundry in Stillwater. How do you get your vision across to others who are going to help you? I don't carve the granite because I'm not a stone carver, but how do you work with people who do? And that's another part of a fabricator. You don't always have to make everything, but you certainly have to create the conditions under which they are made. It's your vision. And at the same time, you're fabricating things together and making them at the same time. It would be nice to have my own foundry, or be nice to have my own stone quarry and my own. But at a certain point, you have to maximize your time, talent, and money.
Do you, most of your pieces, when you work on these installations, is it mostly coming from personal experience or from somebody else's personal experience?
I guess that's a loaded question in some ways. Mm-hmm. All things are personal, but at the same time, you're taking things in from the outside. I do a lot of reading, and I'm very interested in quotes and what they mean, and how do words transpose into objects, and how do objects transpose into metaphors, and how do... So you're taking all of that sensibility with you. So you're really taking things out of the environment. You're out of the environment you create, and then you're giving them back. And as you give them back, you make the sculpture. It's kind of hard to differentiate the idea of public and private there.
Because it all can get mixed in.
It's pretty enfolded.
Yeah. If somebody wanted to get into the type of work that you're doing art-wise, mm-hmm. these larger pieces, what would be your suggested path for them?
Oh, well, first, it does depend on technique. You need to understand how you work these materials. Technique belongs to everybody, but you have to have some.
You have to have a path, is what you're saying? No way.
well, not so much a path, but if you're going to work with wood, you need to learn how woodworking works. If you're going to work with stone, you need to learn how stoneworking works. For instance, I had never worked with glass, and I went to Appalachian Glass, and I did some workshops, and I worked with John Lewis Glass in Oakland, and I called Pittsburgh Glass in Pittsburgh and worked with Heidi and some other people. So in other words, sometimes you need to know enough to know what you need to know.
Gotcha.
And then you do some purposeful practice, and you find out that you can maneuver that material to meet your vision, and you can understand how the material works so that you can help other people work with you.
Well, thanks for stopping by.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you again to local artist and Winona State University professor Dan Eastman for taking the time to share with us on Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.